In May, in British Columbia, 170 people died from suspected illicit drug use. That's more than 5 people a day. It's a 93% increase in death due to overdrug use over last May. Now, compare that to 52 deaths to COVID-19, and it's not unreasonable to ask if the spike in overdose deaths is related to the lockdown associated with C-19. According to Well-Being Trust in the United States, the number of deaths that could be ultimately attributable to COVID-19 as a result of deaths of despair could be as high as 150,000 people. Deaths from alcoholism, drug overdoses, and suicides are also known as deaths of despair, and they were already at record levels in the United States before COVID-19. Dr. Benjamin F. Miller says, "We know the stressors that accompany this pandemic. They are job loss and financial instability, anxiety, grief, depression, and other factors. Then add in social isolation, a loss of hope, and many healthcare programs that simply weren't accessible." Miller follows up saying he's worried about people who need help. We invited Dr. Benjamin F. Miller of Wellbeing Trust to join us for a conversation that matters about the desperate need to reopen assistance programs that can and will save lives.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the following and viewers like you. Please become a patron at conversationsthatmatter.tv.
I was struck when I read your press release and some of the reports that indicated that the unintended consequence of the reaction to COVID-19 could be a tremendous number of deaths, particularly those that you call deaths by despair. What are the factors that are putting people in this position where they are looking at the termination of their own life as being more palatable than moving forward?
Well, it's a good question. And first of all, thank you for having me on. Thanks for having a conversation today that does matter, because this is one that unfortunately many across the world are reticent to have. Issues of mental health, issues of suicide, issues of addiction, they're stigmatized to the point that we are not even comfortable discussing it within our own families. Deaths of despair is a term that was coined by 2 economists, and it really came out after around the 2008 recession. We've actually noticed a trend in deaths of despair since around 1999, but it was the 2008 Great Recession here in the States where we saw a substantial uptick in individuals who were losing their lives to drug, alcohol, and suicide. And I want to just kind of break this out a little bit because I think it's important for your viewers. First of all, opioids has been a major problem here in the States, and I'm assuming there's probably been a little bit of a problem there in your country as well. But we've seen that people taking too many opioids, having them removed, they went and sought other ways to maintain their addiction. And unfortunately, they found other nastier, what we would call a synthetic opioid, that led them to die. And we saw a substantial uptick in that. The other thing we saw was in just a constant influx of suicide. The suicide rates in the United States, at least, have been on the increase for the last several years. So deaths of despair really are driven by multiple factors at once. There are social factors, there are economic factors, and then there's underlying mental health factors, all of which we have been trying to at least pursue strategies that address.
So you talk about these different components, and I think about the response to COVID-19, which forced people into isolation, except for you were able to go out and buy, you know, those products that were deemed essential. And one of those products that was deemed essential appears to me to be alcohol. And I know from my own experience, I would say, well, I want to get some wine. I'd have to stand in a lineup to get into a store. That would take 40 minutes. Well, I'm not going to buy one bottle of wine. I'm going to buy a whole bunch because I don't want to go through this again. Well, right. I'm no different than anyone else. Now I've got a whole bunch of wine sitting there at home. I'm alone. Well, it's really easy for me to overconsume. And I had to actually get to the point where I went, I'm not buying any more wine because, and I don't feel like I'm in a position where I'm held hostage to this. I can make that decision to not do it. I can only imagine that I'm not alone in saying, well, it's there. I got nothing else to do. I'm going to enjoy that extra glass of wine or finish that bottle and so on. And so you put people into isolation, you remove the social norms that would prevent them from overconsuming. And the next thing you know, they are spiraling downwards.
That's right. And for many of us, having the day-to-day routine removed from our lives, going to work from 8 to 5, and it opens up a new opportunity for us to not have that consistent structure that prevents us from maybe having a drink a little earlier. Or it prevents us from thinking about, oh, I've got to be up super early tomorrow morning. Maybe I'll just have that second glass of wine or third glass of wine or whatever it might be. And so almost the entire way that we've approached how we manage address some of our issues during COVID have really come front and center. So folks deal with stressors in all kinds of different ways. Some might find that it's an extra glass of wine that helps calm their nerves or soothe their nerves. Others might find that it's another substance that they've discovered that helps them really manage their anxieties. There are good and bad ways to manage this. But to your point, we've never seen an issue like social isolation, sheltering in place, like we have right now. Nobody studied this at the level that we're all experiencing it. So I think there's probably going to be a lot of learnings that come from this. But for your viewers, probably the most important thing is that we have to continue to take care of our minds just as much as we take care of our bodies. And sometimes that extra glass of wine isn't going to help solve some of the concerns and worries that you might have.
You know, you bring up the topic of social isolation. Why is it so important for us as human beings to be connected to one another, and not the way that we are right now, but I mean actually in the same space? What does that do to us as far as our own well-being, both physically and mentally?
Well, let's first talk about what loneliness and isolation does to our health, and then we'll talk about the importance of why we need to be socially connected. We know that loneliness, and which a lot of folks are lonely, I don't want to minimize this because it's something that many people experience on a daily basis. Loneliness and isolation can be as detrimental to your health as smoking a pack of cigarettes or as being overweight. The long-term impacts on that, on your overall health and well-being, is consequential and substantial. And so we know that the reasons for that is because we are inherently social creatures. We want to have a relationship with someone or something. We want to be able to have it converse with us and to support us. As a colleague of mine has always said, one of the oldest forms of medicine is love. And one of the only ways that sometimes we can get that love is by being in proximity to someone else. It doesn't mean you can't have love and relationships from a distance. But what it does mean is that when we are relational at our core, we do sometimes need to have touch. Mm-hmm. We need to have the presence of someone who can show us empathy beyond a screen, who can tell us that things are going to be okay beyond a text, and who really can be there just to kind of hug us and support us when things are bad. So that's really why social connection matters so much. And in a time of crisis like this, it's somewhat ironic and cruelly ironic that we're being asked to physically distance ourselves, because we've all are experiencing stress in pretty substantial ways. And to not have that social connection, it makes this even worse.
You know, for a long time, I have believed that when somebody actually breaks that barrier between us, collapses the space that is between us physically, emotionally, psychologically, our egos, everything, and you invade into somebody else's space, you actually validate them and they you. And this is, I think, a fundamental characteristic of being a fully functioning person.
Absolutely. And when we think about how our economies are suffering because of COVID, the loss of jobs, and the removal of ourselves from our support systems, which in many cases for many of us are our employers, employees, people that we work with. And so when we remove ourselves from that and we have to go back and try and manage something on our own, it does feel different. It does feel challenging. And to your point, when we're not up in each other's faces sometimes, having that conversation or simply being there to show our support, many of us don't know how to cope with basic stressors, and I would not describe COVID or any of the other crises facing our nations right now as basic.
So one of my understandings about the way that our brains work and function is that when we're being challenged by external thoughts or input from someone else, we're constantly kind of riding the ship of our own thinking. But when we sit there in isolation, we can very easily veer away from what is the real situation. And when those thoughts take hold, of course, our brain has an ability to start to say, well, this is important to you, I'm going to protect that way of thinking, and we continue to veer away. It's without that kind of social interaction, it's almost impossible for us to get back to a place where we can, and this is sort of my next point, find a place where we believe in the future.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, we could spend a long time talking about this one. I mean, in essence, in psychology, there are really three schools of thought. And I'm going to just really quickly generalize this because it's an important point that you're making here around our thoughts. So there are some people that believe that all thoughts have meaning, that every single thought that you have, there's a reason for it. There's some people that believe that no matter what the thought, it can be changed. And then there's this third school of thought that believes that most thoughts don't matter, that they're not even relevant, that you have a lot of thoughts to go through your head that don't need to stick because they're just fleeting thoughts. And so depending on where you are within each of those schools of thought, it really is up to us to decide what makes the most sense on how you can manage thoughts that sometimes get out of control. And for many of us, if we are having those intrusive thoughts that maybe we want to harm ourselves, or maybe we're just really feeling impending doom, which is not hard to feel right now in a time of COVID, we have got to consider what we can do about either addressing those thoughts or changing those thoughts or seeing them for what they are, which is probably just a natural response to a, you know, an external stimuli like COVID.
Well, so that raises the question, of course, in this COVID environment where people now start to, especially if they've seen a dramatic impact on their income, start to develop thoughts of hopelessness. What can we do collectively to ensure, well, maybe collectively isn't the right term, what can we do individually with those people that we know and suspect may be experiencing the challenge of getting out of bed in the morning, of believing in tomorrow? What can we do to support one another? Because really, I think this is a fundamental element of this, and we can't shy away from it.
We can't. And unfortunately, too many of us are uncomfortable even addressing these issues. So if your friend, your colleague, your mate says something to you that, like, I am not sure how I'm going to be able to make it through tomorrow, or I just don't feel like the world needs me anymore, what do you say in response? Do you minimize it? Do you say, you know what? Oh yeah, you're okay. Come on, just toughen up, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Let's go for a walk. I mean, that type of stuff is not usually validating for a person who's experiencing extreme distress or a person who's experiencing depression or symptoms of depression. What we do need to do, which I think is one of the most powerful ways that we can be there to support one another, is simply to be empathic, to understand that people have extreme feelings that are unique to themselves. It is not you to judge how someone else may be feeling at the time. Embrace how they're feeling. Understand where they're coming from. That is a huge interventional strategy and something we don't do very well. Two, don't run away from the hard conversation. Embrace it. If someone mentions that to you on a Sunday, bring it up again on a Monday. Mm-hmm. Ask about it again. Just because the person didn't bring it up doesn't mean it's not still important to them. They may not bring it up again because they're afraid of how you're going to respond the next time. And so it is up to us to really be consistent there. And then the third, and this is a kind of an obvious one, but if you do feel like being there, being empathic, listening, and showing your support isn't enough for the individual, there are folks out there that can help. And in this current climate with COVID, you don't always have to leave your home. There are crisis numbers you can call. I mean, heck, there's even crisis text lines now. You can text people that can help you. There are experts out there that can provide support, whether it be for you who's trying to provide support for a loved one or for your loved one who needs to support themselves. There are technologies that can really be useful right now.
You know, you talk about having that conversation. Many, many years ago, I read Dr. Carl Rogers' book on becoming a person, and he has lessons in there about himself. And he talked about something that really struck a chord with me, and that is that which seems so deeply personal is actually the most universal, even though we may not necessarily want to access it ourselves. I think if we can reach into our own experience and say, yeah, I've been there in moments of despair, and I thought, okay, I can't see a way out. And so I know what that feeling is. And so to be able to share and say, you know, to open up and become vulnerable yourself, that it then creates an opportunity to have a conversation that may otherwise be very, very difficult. Because I think, you know, the worst thing for somebody is that they're going, okay, not only am I losing hope, I'm afraid to reveal this because I'm really uncomfortable about what the consequence of opening up might be. Is that an appropriate strategy?
It is, but I just want to underscore something you said there at the end, because I think this is really critical for people to understand about mental health in general, is that there is a pretty pervasive thing that exists out there called stigma. Mm-hmm. And let me define that, because I actually think it's part of the reason why most of us don't want to have conversations around mental health or addiction. Stigma is defined as difference plus deviance. The difference is I have something that you don't, or you have something that I don't. It's the in versus the out crowd, if we can use those terms. So I have symptoms of depression. I feel depressed. You don't. Okay. The deviance is where it really gets a little tricky, because deviance is that you are treated differently. Mm-hmm. In some cases, you might be ostracized or said, you know, or being told, you know, because you are different, we're going to put you in a separate category, or we're not going to talk to you, or we're going to treat you in a different way that makes you realize how unique and different you are. So the thing about stigma is that it's both social and structural at the same time. The social piece is when we treat people in different ways. The structural piece is when our systems reinforce the fact that mental health is indeed separate, which it's not. And so I think that as societies come to grip with how we're going to talk about mental health, we've got to recognize that if we're going to change the conversation, if we're going to be more empathic and understanding with our fellow man, we've got to understand that there is a deep-rooted culture in our nations that is stigmatizing mental health on a daily basis, whether it's advertently or inadvertently, it's happening.
When I, no matter whom I meet, by virtue of interacting with them, they've changed me. I'm a different person now that I've had this conversation with you. And I try to share that concept with people, everybody that I talk to, that you have changed my life. And mm-hmm. if you weren't here, you wouldn't be changing my life. And so I want you to hang around and have that impact. And there may be times when I don't like the change, and other times that I really embrace it. But in the process, we're making one another better, and hopefully endeavoring to make the world a better place. And so this is what I find so wonderful about the work that you're doing. You're saying we can't let people go. We need them, because every single individual has a contribution to make. That's right. And so the mandate of your organization, I really found very fascinating, because you speak to something that has resonated with me from quite some time. And I had read it through a quote that was attributed to Aristotle, and that is, you know, the responsibility of each of us is to realize our potential as fully as possible, mm-hmm. because yeah. a failure to do so is not a loss just to ourselves, but to all of us.
Oh, I so appreciate that, because we actually just are off a staff retreat where we were all describing how we are in this for all different reasons, but all of us 100% are committed to the mission of advancing mental health and well-being. And to us, you can't do that. You can't flourish as an individual. You can't thrive. You can't achieve your fullest potential if there's not a firm foundation of mental health. And so for us, where we came from, we were started by a health system here in the States. Like many foundations, we were actually created, though, as a gift. We were started by the Providence Health System, which is in Northwest part of the United States. And they said, we have a problem both within our system and within the country, that people are not addressing mental health and well-being in a substantial and comprehensive way. They can't flourish. They can't thrive. So we're going to give some money and create a new organization, an independent organization that goes out there and tries to do a multitude of things at once. So how do we change the way that we deliver care so it's not so fragmented? How do we change the way that we approach our communities so that each of us are given a chance to succeed? Because we know that one size fits all will not work for our communities, that there's too much disparities that are out there, and we've got to create more of an equity type of approach to community. We've got to look at policy and advocacy. If we don't do some of the structural changes within policy, and we don't have a community standing behind us advocating for those changes, we're probably going to see ongoing mediocrity and status quo. We've got to change the way that we socially engage. The narrative around mental health has been wrong for too long. We think of it as the person that's talking to themselves on the street, and we don't think about it as our friends, our family, our next door neighbors. Mental health is all of us, and it is foundational for our health. And finally, we would be doing a total disservice to the entire movement for mental health if we weren't actually measuring and evaluating consistently how effective we were at seeing these changes. So my mentor has always taught me that health is the foundation for achievement. There is no health without mental health, and there is no way to fully achieve the goals that we have for ourselves without having good health. In some cases, that's a roof over our heads. In other cases, that's having access to care. In other cases, it might simply be a job that provides you meaning and a sense of belonging. Whatever it is, we've got to be more responsive to our communities so we mitigate these deaths of despair, and we ultimately bring about a different type of culture, which is one that's more holistic and comprehensive.
Well, I can't help but think that we could also have our own selfish interests at work if we want somebody else to be well. Because when you're well, you're living a fully productive life. You're contributing in ways that you wouldn't if you weren't in that state. You as an individual, your family, your community, the business that you work for, society as a whole, we all benefit when we can support one another to realize our full potential and to be as healthy as possible.
That's one arm, I think, to the antidote of what ails us, which is that service and putting others first and really doing something in response to crises or even just in response to need. It does provide more of a healing effect on the person doing the service.
Right.
When we look at issues of loneliness and isolation and lack of belonging, we know that the best way to solve those problems is to give people something to do for someone else. And it's actually, it's not rocket science here, but it is sometimes hard to find new jobs that provide meaning or to provide a community service opportunity in the face of COVID or sheltering in place. But when we get through this, and we will get through this, our countries have got to come together, our communities have got to come together and figure out a way that we can enhance our service to each other. That will, I think if we did just that, we would see a tremendous shift in life expectancy in the right direction. We would see a decrease in some of the deaths of despair. And most importantly, I think that people would walk away feeling like that they had a sense of belonging within their own communities, which unfortunately has not been the case for several years for many of us.
Well, hopefully having more and more conversations like this will open people up to the fact that we can make a difference in the lives of people that we care about and to the community as a whole. Thank you very much.
I hope so.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining me on this conversation. It's very important to me.